Jose B. Gonzalez is the editor of Latino Boom, an anthology of U.S. Latino literature. He is a professor, a scholar, and a poet. This is his first book of poetry called Toys Made of Rocks. And his poetry has been included in many anthologies and many journals, including Callaloo, Calabash, and Palabra. Jose Gonzalez, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. I'm really looking forward to this. You do some great things out there in Texas, and I tell you, to be a part of this is really cool, considering that I'm way over in the Northeast, and so it's about to get colder, and you're bringing me some, I think, some warm vibes, so I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you. And you know, it always feels weird when somebody refers to where I'm from or where I live as Texas. I mean, it is Texas, but it just kind of seems weird because, you know, there's this view of Texas, which, of course, is incredibly inaccurate because Texas is Texatlan, if any place is.
That's right.
But still, it kind of jars me, especially being from California and, you know, where Californians have these attitudes about Tejanos, or not Tejanos specifically, but Texans. But we're in El Paso. We're on the border. And it's like living in Mexico here with just a lot of Walgreens on the corners.
Well, I tell you, it's like different countries there, and I mean that. I got the opportunity to speak at a couple of colleges a few years back, Corpus Christi, and that was really nice. And I got a really warm welcome. And I went to Dallas and used some of the same words, and I saw a lot of crossed arms that day, and people didn't really welcome some of the things that I had to say. So I've seen some of that, you know, just I think politically and otherwise, just in terms of the populations.
Yeah.
Two different worlds.
Yeah, definitely. Let's start with talking a little bit about you. Tell us who Jose B. Gonzalez is, where he came from, and most importantly, how you came into poetry.
Sure. I am a Salvadoreño, first and foremost. I am an immigrant. I am proud of that. I know that nowadays, you know, there are a lot of people who bash immigrants, and you know, I'll be the first to tell you that I'm one of the things that I'm most proud of is the fact that I came here at the age of 8, and then I grew up in housing projects, and that, you know, a lot of times we get the view of Connecticut as being this wealthy state, which it is, but when a state is wealthy, there's always someone who has to do the manual labor, and that's what my parents
did. Right.
You know, they had some tough jobs along the way, and first and foremost, I'm just that, an immigrant who fell in love with words, I think, as a young child, and who discovered poetry along the way and as a way to really express some things that I really couldn't say. You know, a language, I think, failed me in English and in Spanish. And so I found that poetry was really that medium where, you know, in some cases, I was the only one who knew what the heck I meant. And, you know, some emotions were just too complex to really articulate, right, as a child. I knew what I meant. And then I kept writing. You know, I think love, first and foremost, I think is what got me into poetry, or I should say failures in love, right, got me into poetry. And then I just kept writing. And so, fortunately, you know, my new collection, it was a way for me to express some of my experiences along the way as I've now become a professor of English. I have a PhD in English and have been fortunate enough to be a Fulbright scholar and, you know, all those things that have to do with language studies and literature, U.S. literature. And so that is more or less who I am.
That's interesting that you you only spoke Spanish and you had to acquire English. And do you still speak Spanish?
I do, but, you know, let me tell you something. It is quite the challenge here in the Northeast, especially when I was growing up. We were one of the few families, Latino families, in the area, and the only Salvadorian family. And then, you know, everyone knew the Salvadoreños, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, little by little, more family came here, but opportunities to speak Spanish were somewhat limited, right? And so I do speak it. It's not very good, sadly.
Right.
You know, I miss some words here and there. As a matter of fact, I was having a conversation with someone one day, a woman who friend who teaches Spanish, and I'm asking her about when her friend or her husband is going to retire. And she looked at me, gave me a strange look. And sure enough, I looked up what word I was using afterwards. And I was using, instead of, you know, there's jubilat and then fusilat, right? And then I was, you know, pretty much asking her how, not when he was going to retire, but when he was going to shoot himself. It's no wonder she gave you these looks. But, you know, and making those kinds of mistakes along the way, unfortunately. Yeah, right. And, you know, the opportunity to speak is just not as much as it could be. And I think it's gotten better, but, yeah, you know, that's one of the fallouts, I guess, of having this track in English and not in dual languages. I really admire people like you who are able to do both, and writers who are able to translate their own words, right? They don't even need a translator, I guess, you know.
Don't admire me in that respect too much, because I know my Spanish is bad? When I speak it with somebody who speaks very little English, they would rather struggle with English than have a conversation with me in Spanish.
Oh, no. Oh, easy. Okay.
No, not really that bad. I mean, I definitely speak like a gabacho, you know, but I grew up on English. I didn't grow up on Spanish. And I grew up around Spanish. And for us, when we were kids, I remember, you know, one of the things that I found beautiful and peaceful was when we would go visit my grandparents and all the family would be there. My grandparents didn't speak English. And so the adults would have to speak Spanish to them, and none of the kids understood. But falling asleep to the sound of adults at the table speaking Spanish just to me was just so beautiful. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why I love language, you know, to begin with. And you were talking about learning English and falling in love with language. Do you remember like a particular memory where language just struck you so much that you thought, wow, there's something here I want to explore further?
Yeah, you know, I think it was, yeah, I always had an interest in poetry, but in particular Langston Hughes, right? I liked his music, right?
Right.
I liked his lyrics. I mean, just some beautiful stuff. But for me, the transformative time came during high school when some friends were going in one track and other friends were going in tracks that led to these mean streets, right? These unforgiving streets, and they're making money in ways that really they shouldn't have been, right?
Selling drugs and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I used to sell joints in the boys' bathroom when I was in seventh grade, so I was one of the ones that went on the bad track.
Right. So that's really when you start to figure out, right? You have to make some tough decisions. And so I had read Shakespeare, and I was one of these geeks who really liked it. Read it in English class. And one day I actually wound up stealing a Shakespeare anthology from the classroom.
Beautiful.
And, I mean, talk about...
Yeah, you wrote a poem about that. Right? That poem is in this book.
You know, some people steal money. I'm going to steal a Shakespeare anthology. And believe it or not, I still have it.
Wow.
And for me, that was really transformative, because I was able to read Shakespeare at home and kind of try to figure some of that out. And, you know, some of the language and some of the storylines and metaphors and all that. I really thought that in many ways I wound up kind of stealing Shakespeare in a number of ways, right?
Literally,
but also in terms of language, right?
Oh, I love that. That's great. Yeah, that's fantastic use of that word, steal. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was actually going to be the title of this collection, or that was one of, I thought maybe I could kind of play on that, and everyone I mentioned that title to said, no, that's too cliché-ish, and they were absolutely right, I thought.
So what was the title going to be? Stealing Shakespeare?
Yeah, Stealing Shakespeare, you know, which I think might fit metaphorically, but at the same time, just much too cliché-ish.
I don't know. I kind of like it.
Yeah, well, maybe part two of Stealing Shakespeare.
And, you know, it shows that, you know, there was something about language, you found something inside of it. You went deeply into it and you found something. And what you found, a lot of it had to do with finding how to express your own feelings.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. And so when you were heartbroken by somebody, poetry came to your rescue.
It absolutely did. And it was bad poetry. I'll be the first.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
We all write bad poetry.
We have to.
Revenge poetry, you know, revenge on a lover poetry, that kind of thing. But I mean, it was soothing. And in many ways, just as much as it could be for a 14, 15-year-old.
Right. You know, and we always hear as writers from our students, writing is therapy. You know, and we've heard that actually from many sources,
yeah.
Writing is therapy. And I've always rejected that idea because I used to think, well, no, it's not therapy. It needs to be more than therapy. It needs to, you know, blah, 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 you know, whatever rhetoric I used at the time. But I'm coming around again and saying, yeah, it is kind of therapeutic in the sense that you do go deep and you do go for the jugular. You do go for what hurts. I have heard a lot of poets tell me, and I'm going to ask you this question too, they tell me they write about what hurts. If it hurts, they write about it. What do you think of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I guess it depends on the author, right? I mean, sometimes I think authors don't like to delve too deeply and go perform that heart surgery, right? And I'll tell you, I when I worked on this collection, I really had a tough time with it because they were emotionally, right?
Right.
Times when I thought, wow, I feel like I just fought 15 rounds here, and this is, I don't know if I can do this. And so I started working on a second collection, right, after this one was published, or after I signed the contract. And I thought, I'm not going to do the same thing, right, because this is emotionally draining. This is not the way to go about it. And then, sure enough, I found myself caring about the character that I was writing about, right? In a way that it was almost like he was coming to life, in a way like he was my relative or a child of mine, right? And I think that was good for the writing, actually. That was a good exercise in that sense. That it showed that I was pouring the right words, I thought, or at least really thinking about what words I was using.
It reminds me of, you know, Benjamin Alira.
Oh, yeah,
He's here at UTEP and here in El Paso. He was also a co-host of the show when I first began.
Yeah, I remember.
He used to tell me, you know, if it doesn't hurt, just, you know, give up. Like, stop.
Wow.
You know? And he, of course, writes some incredibly painful poetry and fiction.
Yeah.
But you have written a book called Toys Made of Rock. It's a collection of poems, and there is a lot of pain in it. And I even want to say sometimes there's a bit of anger, and I don't know if that's the right word for you, but I'd like to start by talking about a poem that you have called quite cleverly, and this, you know, maybe this could have been the title. Who knows? But although Toys Made of Rocks, I think, is a brilliant title. You have a poem called Autobiography of a New England Latino. And as I read this, I hate to assume, you know, that the speaker of the poem is the poet.
Oh, yeah. It's
but
me, yeah.
Yeah, in this collection, I kind of had to assume.
Yeah.
Tell us how that autobiography came about.
Well, I'll tell you, going into academia, I mean, we talk about turf wars, right? And I think that time and time again, anytime I read this poem in front of academics, right? There might be some students, but it's a lot of times it's academics who say, you know, what you wrote and what you said about being in a field is pretty much what I experienced. And it's not always that they're in English. They could be in whatever field, but somehow they feel isolated, right? They feel like, you know, for example, if they're in the political arena, and their expertise is on Latino or Latin American politics, right? They feel like they're marginalized in one way. And I wrote this piece at a time when I thought, where are we going with Latino literature, right? What are we doing with it? I had been working on, along with John Christie, on an anthology, Latino Boom,
right,
which includes your wonderful work.
Yeah.
And sure enough, time and time again, I found that I felt like the publisher wasn't really doing much with it,
mm-hmm.
which I know can be true of a lot of publishers. But I had gone, for example, we had talked to the publisher about making sure that it was representative. And I think that in some cases, they didn't really give priority to making decisions that would have made the anthology more reflective of Latino literatures, right? So, for example, they cut down pages from, we were supposed to have 600 to they went down to like 300, 400. All these things, right? So it was this frustration on my part, and I began to write about this frustration that I had felt not only in academia, but I said, well, you know, this actually started, some of this started way back when, you know?
Yeah.
And then I really thought about my experience in terms of why else, other than the field, the discipline itself. And I think autobiography is intentionally about being brown, right? Because,
right.
You know, Latinos, we're going to come in, you know, all shades and we're going to come in, you know, all eye colors and whatnot. But for me, particularly, you know, my experience in the Northeast, and maybe this isn't true of everyone, but I felt like this brownness was part of the reason why this kind of marginalization was taking place, not only in academia, but also throughout my life, right? Whether I was in college and getting an English award, or whether I was trying to teach English, right, out of college, and headmaster telling me, no, you should teach Spanish, right? So anyway, it really because of those experiences. It's interesting because I thought that poem, it flowed fairly well. Okay. And I think it's because that emotion was so strong. And when I say it flowed well, I meant like it. Once I started writing it, it came pretty easy. Some of the poems that I have are
you went into it. You went into a trance, and then suddenly you looked, and there was a poem on the page, a very long one. That's great.
Yeah,
I love
exactly.
when that happens.
Exactly.
Awesome. I'm talking to Jose B. Gonzalez, who is, along with John Christie, editor of Latino Boom, which is an anthology, one of very important anthologies still in print. Of Latino works. It's a fantastic book, and I'm not just saying that because one of my stories is in there. It's just a fantastic book, but we're here to talk about his new book, which is a collection of poems called Toys Made of Rock. And in the poem that basically wrote itself, and this happens to a lot of us, you know, we say that. We say a poem wrote itself, meaning we basically are a vessel, and, you know, and to put it one way, we're a vessel, and the pen starts moving, or we start typing, and before you know it, there's a poem. And did we intend it? Who knows? I mean, we just submitted to it. But it's called Autobiography of a New England Latino, and there's this one passage that really struck me, and I'm going to read it. It says, when I tell people that I'm a professor of English, every once in a while someone says something like, Dr. Brown, you must teach a different type of English that has to have some kind of brown. And I love the repetition of the word brown, brown, brown throughout the entire poem. But tell us about that image of, has that happened a lot to you where people, you know, like you teach English? What kind of English?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember being in conferences, for example, and actually I did a presentation one time on Shakespeare's language, right? Mm-hmm. And I did it with a colleague, right? So after the presentation, sure enough, you know, we're expecting Q&A, right? As people come up to you, you know how that goes. And sure enough, not one person came up to me to talk to me about what I presented. There was a line
right.
for her, and I'm thinking,
oh,
okay.
Oh, gosh, I know how that feels.
Kind of interesting, right?
Right.
Yeah, the way that this evolved. So, you know, not just there, but even, you know, even in housing, you know, even in housing, going to places and trying to find my first house, and time again, realtors saying, yeah, you know, because you work at the casino, so you're going to be very close, and, you know, kind of making these assumptions along the way that were just based on what they saw, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, I felt like they had already come to their own conclusion, but what's worse than that, it was without asking questions,
right?
And I think that's the tough part.
Well, yeah, I can totally relate to that. When I first got out of graduate school, I got a job teaching at a small community college in California, and I was full-time English. But everybody would ask me, oh, ESL, that would be their follow-up question. I go, no, English.
And you heard it.
Yeah, and I remember even one time parking my car in the faculty parking lot, and a security guard followed me all the way to my office, you know, saying, I can't park there. It's for faculty only. Where did I get the sticker?
You know,
all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And you know, it's funny because reading your book, there's all kinds of incidents like that. A lot of the poems, if not angry, are at least really passionate about certain issues, racism, immigration. Was there a lot of anger in some of these poems? And how did you fight the anger in such a way that it didn't just kill the poem?
Yeah, you know, it was really through writing and thinking, okay, it is anger, but it's also goes back to what I was saying before that poetry captures something that we really can't say, right, through plain ordinary language. So yeah, it was anger, but it's also disappointment, and it's also this sadness, right, at the same time. It's all these things, and kind of shock and awe, right, to use, you know, a totally inappropriate phrase, but yeah. For example, going to grad school, I remember going into a professor's class and asking for help, and she said, so you want to play with the big boys now? Really? Yeah, really? That's how you're going to treat me, right? And just playing all these games, she would say all these things in class about immigrants, about people who speak more than one language and how they think they're smarter than others. And, you know, and I'm looking around, and you know it's just me. I mean, there's no one else. There's no other Gonzalez. I mean, it's not even close, right? And so, yeah, some of that was anger, but some of that, too, was just this kind of shock. Like, how do I put that into words so that the reader then turns around and says, yeah, I think I can call it anger, but I'm not exactly positive because it's not your traditional someone cut me off in the middle of a highway kind of anger, right?
Right.
It's different. It's more personal and extends, I think, into other emotions.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, I don't want to give the impression that there's ranting going on here.
Sure.
And because it really isn't. But there's a lot of irony, you know. There's a lot of passion. And I wanted to ask you, if you had to, I don't know why you would have to do it, but if somebody tied you up and said, Jose, top three things you're passionate about, what are those top three things and how do they fit into your poetry?
Well, I like that question. What a great question. I think, for one, justice, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's crucial. Education and children, those three. And those three can't always be separated, you know, children's rights, education, and justice. And unfortunately, that's been one of our major flaws, right, in our educational system, mm-hmm. is that, you know, we have a lot of young brown, young Latino students who are failing not because they themselves have failed themselves, but because the system, right, public school systems have not provided them with the kind of justice, the kind of education that they truly, truly deserve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really think that if you look at high schools, I mean, you growing up in L.A., I think you know much more, you've seen much more than I have. But time and time again, you would think that something like that would be resolved, right? And
right.
And time and time again, you see people pointing to the students as if they're the ones who are at fault, as opposed to the funding, as opposed to the resources or lack thereof. And so those three areas, I think there's something that I'm not only passionate about, but I think that, you know, I've tried here and there to do as much as I could to make sure that there's more equity, right?
Right. Definitely. Your passion comes out, and it's a fantastic collection. It's called Toys Made of Rock. The writer is Jose B. Gonzalez. Can we close with a poem? Would you read a poem from your collection?
Yeah, thank you. I want to read The Thanksgiving of No Mas, right? Oh. Only because Roberto Duran, he is out in theaters, and I haven't seen the movie yet, but you know, I'll be there. The Thanksgiving of No Mas. They said he had hands of stone. His scarred face showed that he had been pelted with Panamanian rocks as he trained himself to get out of neighborhoods made of concrete that had caved in tender spots from man-made earthquakes. The leather on his skin matched his championship belts. He was one of us, knew what a man does when the ground snaps, when the world starts to spin and open its mouth so wide and swallows those who can't get themselves to palm shelters. My father's friends had stepped into our boxing room to watch the match. They never wore gloves, but they had been boxing all their lives. It was November, and the cold of a new winter season had started to step and seep into our home. Before the first blow pounded flesh, my father and his friends passed around a hat and collected their rage as if they were tossing coins into Sunday's collection box. Each time their man jabbed, they would say, Esas mia, until they all claimed credit for every punch that landed. Then Sugar Ray became a windmill in there. Don Quixote had nothing but sweaty air, eyes glared as Sugar Ray danced without music, made a drum out of the hero of Panama, the Avenger of Latin America. As beer can sat still, their fighter swings got slower. The eighth round arrived, as unexpected as a soldier's sudden invasion. And just as they were expecting a tank to fire off a shot, a sniper wounded their fighter in the back. Instead of running for cover under attack, my father and his friends watched as the battle ended with a white flag with the words, "No mas." It was an end they could not accept. Nobody wept. The house erupted. Ashes burned. They weren't sure what stung more, seeing Roberto Duran bury his fists or having to dig up their own day after day, morning after morning, job after job, jab after jab. Thank you.
That was Jose B. Gonzalez reading from his new collection, Toys Made of Rock. Jose, thank you for joining us on Words
Thank
on
you.
Wire.
What a pleasure.